Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Thanks for joining us for a few hours tonight. We've got a trio of great guests lined up and a lot of ground to cover. Many of you might remember the quirky and award-winning film Melvin and Howard, which told the improbable story of Melvin Dumar and his encounter in the Nevada desert with one of the richest men in the world, Howard Hughes. The likable Dumar saved Hughes' life that night, though he didn't believe the old man when he claimed to be Hughes. After Howard Hughes died, a handwritten will surfaced, which named Dumar as one of the beneficiaries, would have meant millions and millions of dollars. His life was never the same after that, and the story has taken many twists and turns in the decades since. Because of the tireless efforts of a dogged ex-FBI agent named Gary Magnuson, we finally have a clearer picture of the dark forces and big money that aligned against Melvin Dumar. It's been several years since we had him on the program, but since that appearance, new evidence and witnesses have come forward. So tonight, Gary Magnuson will fill us in on the latest findings about one of the strangest and darkest conspiracy tales in modern jurisprudence. And Melvin Dumar will join us as well tonight. I still get a lot of emails about the Howard Hughes saga and know that many of you will want to hear this new stuff. But first, an event that may have driven the final nail into the coffin of the mythology surrounding the 60s as being an era of peace and love. Altamont, the film Gimme Shelter, has long been considered the definitive account of what went down at the Altamont Speedway in December 1969 and what was supposed to be Woodstock West, a free concert for what turned out to be about 300,000 people. But a new book by highly regarded journalist Joel Selvin, a veteran of the music scene, reveals details that most of us never knew. Based on more than 100 interviews with principal players in the tragic fiasco and 30 years of research, it's a terrific and sweeping piece of work that is as much about the deeper undercurrents that were unfolding at that time as it was about the events of that day. Things that are still unfolding, in fact. Joel Selvin joins me in just a minute to talk about his epic book on Altamont, the Rolling Stones, the Hells Angels, and the inside story of rock's darkest day. Not sure if you've heard the news yet, but golfing legend Arnold Palmer died today. Palmer was one of the most charismatic and beloved athletes of the 20th century. He was 87. Webmaster Greg Bishop and I have put together our usual assortment of items and oddities. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast website. Among tonight's stories, an update on the infamous Skinwalker Ranch. As you might know, I have a long-standing interest in that epicenter of weirdness in northeastern Utah, and I hinted last week that some news was coming. Well, it's here, and you can read about it on the website. While you're there, check out how to become a Coast Insider. You can subscribe to this program and listen anytime you want, as many times as you want, for pennies a day. It's still a great deal. You can also check out the link to Beyond Belief, George Norrie's TV program, available by subscription as well. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog, pour some milk for the cat, put on a pot of Joe, slip into those jammies, the silky ones, of course, turn down the light and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, Joel Selvin and the story of one of rock's darkest days, Altamont. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. The 1960s was among the most tumultuous decades in American history. It's when the counterculture movement blossomed, JFK, the moon landing, flower power, and the hippies. There were people who thought that it really might develop into something like a real-life Age of Aquarius or Camelot. But the decade ended in bloodshed, political assassinations, racial strife, mass demonstrations, war, the Manson family, and finally with Altamont, literally at the end of the 60s, December 1969. A final punctuation point, and in the view of many, the figurative end of an era. For 30 years, award-winning journalist Joel Selvin has been gathering the information and testimony that went into his epic and sweeping new book, Altamont, the Rolling Stones, the Hells Angels, and the inside story of rock's darkest day. It's a terrific piece of work that goes way beyond merely a chronology of the events of that day. Joel, welcome to the program.
Thank you, George. Good to be here.
Hey, rave reviews for the book so far. I read it this weekend, and I found out why you're getting those kind of reviews. You've written a dozen other books about music, musicians, counterculture, and it seems from my vantage point that working at the San Francisco Chronicle, you were at the right place in the right era. All that previous work seemed to lead up to this. You tie a lot of threads together in this book.
Thanks. It was the most challenging part of writing the book was getting that underscore properly composed. The foreground action kind of takes care of itself. You know how that goes.
Sure. What did you set out to do? Why did this story need to be told?
So it's interesting because, I've been around the Chronicle since, 1970, and the stench was still in the air. And over the course of my time at the paper, I came to know people that played the concert, that worked as stagehands or attended the show. I mean, the lore was just part of my scene. And it wasn't so much in my mind to do this book, but there were people that were encouraging me to. And so in the process of thinking about doing a book proposal, I drove down to Monterey, which is about 2.5 miles or 2.5 hours south of San Francisco, and visited with Rock Scully. And Rock was the manager of the Grateful Dead, and I've always been very fond of Rock, hadn't seen him in a long time. It was a beautiful sunny day. We had lunch outdoors. Rock looked gorgeous. I kept taking pictures of him. And he told me the story of how Altamont began. And I'd never heard it. I don't know that many people had, and it was just like driving home. It was like having a gold nugget in my pocket. It was just struck me as the way a book should begin. And about 2 months later, Rock died. And he'd been sick that day. But I like I said, man, he looked great. And I realized that this whole thing was evaporating and that I really needed to press forward in this story. As I began to write the book and do the research, I just fell into the story. It's a fantastic narrative.
Well, the story starts with him, with this guy you're talking about, who went to London to talk to the Rolling Stones. And the picture you paint of that band at the time is, it's unbelievable that the fact that the Stones were essentially broke in 1969, as big as they were. Right?
They were completely broke, and they had a manager also managing the Beatles at that time who had just simply bottlenecked all their royalties. And they were advised that if they wanted to create more revenue, they needed to start a company that their manager wasn't a participant in. So they decided to tour the United States. And they hadn't been over here for 3 years. They put together the deals real fast. They asked for top dollar everywhere. And since they didn't have any money, they had to finance the tour by collecting advances from the concert promoters, which was a highly unusual proposition. And those concert promoters squealed like crazy until they put the tickets on sale because they all sold out, all except one show.
You make a point that the Stones had no idea. In that 3 years, the music scene here had changed so much. The British wave had sort of peaked and a new kind of music scene had emerged. A lot of it, most of it, based in San Francisco. How had things changed? How out of touch were they?
Well, they were Olympian status, right, at the top of the world of rock in London. And their new records were the greatest records of their careers at that point, Beggar's Banquet and the one they were working on that would become Let It Bleed. That was released the week of Altamont. So the Stones, as a creative, functioning rock band, they were at the peak of their powers. But in the ensuing 3 years, since they had been in the United States, so much had happened. And the whole Woodstock thing, which had taken place in August, all those bands, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, The Band, Creedence Clearwater, Sly and the Family Stone, Santana. All these were like fresh new bands, most of them from San Francisco, as a matter of fact. But so the rock scene had just exploded. I mean, the big new band on the scene in that fall, October, was Led Zeppelin. They were doing a 2.5 hour set, including like a 1/2 hour drum solo. And they were the most exciting thing going on right there. And the last time the Stones had been in this country, they did a 1/2 hour set on top of a bill with a bunch of 1-2 hit wonders and got out of town as soon as they were done.
You make the point that once the tour was underway, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but once the tour was underway and they're playing to these audiences, it's a revelation for them because they're actually, people are listening to the music instead of teenage girls screaming at the top of their lungs.
It was a very exciting time for them. They hit Hollywood before they started the tour and finished up the album with some sessions there. But the excitement of being in the Hollywood nightlife and being the superstars that they were just struck them right away. And then, like you say, the shows were just, the impact was extraordinary, way beyond anything they had imagined or could envision. And they real quickly got the idea that this was an opportunity for more than just some fast bucks, that this really looked like the yawning maw of great opportunity.
You make the point, too, that although they needed money and they wanted to make as much as they could, they also had to sort of straddle the fence and appear that it didn't really matter to them because they wanted to appeal to this new counterculture that seemed to believe that music should be free, which I guess that feeling is in vogue again these days.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine how that was at the time from our vantage point today, George, you know, but there was just this thing in the air that bands should play for free and music should belong to the people. And of course it was an empty cliche, but the whole Woodstock event where they broke down the fences and turned the concert into a free concert, all this coming out of the San Francisco scene where bands in the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood lived really near Golden Gate Park. And they did quite frequently, the Jefferson Airplane or the Grateful Dead or Big Brother and the Holding Company. Just on a sunny day, on the whim, they would go set up their gear and play. And that was part of this mythology out of San Francisco that was so misunderstood and so not witnessed firsthand by people in London or even New York and Chicago and Los Angeles, as a matter of fact. But in London, where the San Francisco hippie was looming so large, they were really acting on impressions garnered from reports, secondhand reports.
And the reality was that the hippie movement, the flower children, were already gone by 69. That it was a much different scene in Haight-Ashbury, as you describe in the book.
So true. And that was one of the more complex parts to lay out, that the initial innocence and optimism of the summer of 66 had been crushed by the tremendous public outpouring of both interest and antipathy. But the 100,000 or so kids that came to San Francisco during the so-called Summer of Love, they pretty much drove out the original hippies and spread them into the hinterlands, living on ranches and getting into the country.
And even the Grateful Dead had moved from Haight-Ashbury.
That's right.
And it was because of sort of the street people had replaced the hippies. It was a different scene altogether. Even the drugs had changed from smoking weed and dropping acid to much harder drugs that left people just like zombies.
Yeah, speed picked up a lot of popularity on Haight Street in the so-called Summer of Love. And, you know, one of the problems at Altamont, and it's an important part of the book, was the way the drug scene had changed over the course of that period of time. In 1966, 67, the people that made LSD were zealots. You know, they were missionaries. And the chemists went to great lengths to make sure that those compounds were stable. 2 years later, the psychedelic world had taken on so much popularity, and the manufacturer had devolved into a criminal enterprise. And the people that were making the psychedelics were adding things to it like strychnine, which is a poison that happens to make the trip last a little longer, or methamphetamine, which overstimulated the users, led to a common symptom was the user would take off their clothes and just be naked. And there was a lot of that at Altamont. A lot of the drugs at Altamont were just poison, and there was just a massive amount of them.
So the Stones need to make some money. They want to do a tour of the States. They have the guy from the Grateful Dead come over to sort of put them back into touch and what the reality of putting that kind of a tour together would be. And the idea starts forming about ending it all with this giant free concert somewhere. But they didn't really know where it was going to be, right?
I think about that. So, yeah, it all started late night in London when Keith Richards found out that Rock Scully had a bunch of California Sensimilla, a kind of exotic type of marijuana that really hadn't showed up much in London. So Rock was summoned to meet with Keith, and, you know, they stayed up all night smoking weed and having a great time. And that's when Rock told Keith that he could fix it for the Stones to play a free concert in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. And his plan was that he would take out a permit under the name of Jefferson Airplane or Grateful Dead, and then 24 hours before the show, they would spring the Rolling Stones as a special surprise guest. And, you know, this idea sort of hung in there with Keith, but I got to wonder, like, what did Keith think? I mean, he didn't really have a lot of experience with San Francisco hippies, and Rock was certainly a brilliant, very verbal, highly educated in, like, private schools and European guy, but at the same time, he'd taken so much LSD, his pupils had disappeared, and his eyes were just these brown dots that floated in buttermilk. And he was kind of like the attention deficit disorder poster child. I loved Rock, but, you know, his job with the Grateful Dead was kind of like to confound and confuse the straight world. They weren't interested in having some, you know, establishment businessman as their representative. But I wonder if Keith knew that. You know, I wonder if Keith thought that Rock put on a suit and went to an office on Monday morning. You know, I don't know. I wonder how serious Rock took the whole thing, because he also talked about that same night, oh, you know, we ought to do a Rolling Stones concert at Stonehenge. And Taj Mahal, that'd be great. That we should do one there, too. So I don't know, like, how exactly, you know, that communication went down. But when the Stones got to Los Angeles, Keith had shared this idea, and it had some currency in the Stones camp.
Well, more so because of the criticism that some colleagues of yours, Ralph Gleason and others, were writing about the Stones tour and their ticket prices, which you look at it compared to what you pay for a show today, and they seem incredibly modest. But at the time, it was, I guess, seemingly outrageous.
Yeah, more than twice what the other concerts were going for. And they were the band everybody wanted to see, so it was just, you know, in the parlance of the day, a straight-out ripoff. However, as you pointed out, the rock scene was cradled by the counterculture, and that was such a sort of politically conscious movement at the time that is really important for you to pay some kind of obeisance to those ideals, right? And you can't just come to America and just, you know, take as much money out of it as you can. Or at least you can't be seen as doing that, right? And you have to, like, give lip service to, well, oh, you know, music is for the people. So right away at their very first press conference, when they're asked about ticket prices, and Jagger's quite disingenuous, really, you know, tickets are high price. He starts talking about the possibility of doing a free concert.
There was an incredible amount of naivete in the whole thing. I mean, you can see they're charging high prices, and then they're going to throw out this idea of a free concert to sort of mollify the criticism. But there's naivete on their part about, all right, we're going to do it, and then nobody really taking control and making sure it happens. Somehow it will all come together as if by magic pixie dust or something.
Combination of innocence and arrogance. A dangerous cocktail, eh, George?
So they start their tour. They come to America. It's a big hit. There's a lot of momentum building. They're back on top again, and then they're still just days away from this planned free concert in December 1969, and nothing is falling into place. So several different locations were considered. They settle on a speedway, and then they change their minds 36 hours before. When we come back, we're going to get into that part of the story. This is the first song that was played at Altamont by Santana. It's called Sabor. Back to Joel Selvin talking about Altamont here on Coast to Coast AM. This was the opening number for the headliners at Altamont, the Rolling Stones, Jumpin' Jack Flash. We're talking with Joel Selvin about his new book, Altamont, the Rolling Stones, the Hells Angels, and the inside story of rock's darkest day. An epic piece of work about the events that led up to and the events of that day. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the schism within the counterculture and the arrival of the Hells Angels. You mix all that in with a bunch of booze and drugs, you got a formula for disaster. Stick around. Joel, in your book, you mention the schisms that had developed in the counterculture, the hippies and flower children on one side of it, the political activists of the left on the other, anti-war movement, for example. And then you add into that sort of the different views of the Hells Angels. As you report, the Stones had a very stilted view of the Angels based on some experiences they had with a pseudo Hells Angels group in London. And it was further complicated by how some people, such as Ken Kesey, viewed the relationship they had with the Hells Angels, and which all sort of combined to lead to have them as part of the security team at Altamont. You want to go into that?
So it's pretty easy to explain, actually. Because when Rock Scully took Sam Cutler, the tour director for the Rolling Stones, to meet with some officials of the San Francisco chapter of the Hells Angels, under the premise that they're going to be there, let's invite them. And the first thing that the Hells Angels told Sam is, we're not cops. And Sam said, oh, well, you know, there's plenty of ways you can help out. So at that time, the concert was planned for San Francisco, in which case the San Francisco chapter would hold jurisdiction. And those guys were well known to the bands. They hung out backstage, they rode their bikes together, they did business together. They were all together a more civilized bunch than, say, the San Jose chapter of the Hells Angels, who were the guys in front of the stage that day at Altamont causing a lot of the trouble. And those that chapter was brand new. They'd won a turf war down in San Jose, which is about 60 miles outside of San Francisco, against the Gypsy Jokers. And they'd wiped the Gypsy Jokers out and just started this Hells Angels San Jose chapter, oh, you know, 4 or 5 months before. And those guys were recruited from the Gypsy Jokers and from the South San Francisco. And they were not the kind of guys that were used to grooving in the park with the hippies.
And the story that's told for many years is they're offered $500 worth of beer, basically, just to keep an eye on the stage or the equipment, not to act as cops, right?
People really helped out a lot there. The film crew that was working for the directors, Albert and David Maisels, they were guided around by Angels. The medical tent had a lot of help from the Angels. Backstage, there was a lot of help. Some of those guys were as appalled and aghast at what went on as anybody was. It was an out of control situation. The Angels were placed in as a bulwark between a 4 foot tall stage and 300,000 people pressing down from a mile away. Naive perhaps, but the Angels thought that if they put their motorcycles in front of the stage, nobody would cross that barrier, because everybody knew not to mess with an Angel's bike.
So it's, you know, they thought about Golden Gate Park. The Grateful Dead's folks figured they could pull off a switcheroo, bring in the Stones and unveil them as surprise guests. That didn't happen for a variety of reasons. They looked around for other locations, thought they had one all lined up, a different speedway. And then 36 hours before the event is supposed to happen, they had to change. So there's they go to Altamont, which is woefully unprepared for an event of this size. In what ways was it unprepared? Every way, I guess.
Well, yeah, pretty much. Starting with the location, which is like at the extreme eastern end of Alameda County in the East Bay, 60, 70 miles east of San Francisco, past the suburbs, past Exurbia, past cow pastures, really on the very edge of the Central Valley, what the classic middle of nowhere. The guy was about out of business, Dick Carter, who had the Altamont Speedway. Biggest crowd he'd ever had before was 6,000 for a demolition derby.
Wow. So there's no bathrooms.
Water, yeah. No concessions. Brought in 100 toilets. Then, 300,000 people showed up. That's pretty much like a major city. 100 toilets in a major city.
And they, they had started the construction of the stage at this other speedway, and suddenly they had to switch locations, and this thing that they end up with, as you mentioned, the reason they really needed the Hells Angels is because all they had between the stage and the audience was a piece of string, right?
Yeah. When they put the stage together that morning, they put a string across the front row, and now you guys stay back. They built that stage overnight in the dark. Talk to stagehands that tell me it's very difficult to put speakers in phase in the dark, and there wasn't a lot of flashlights to go around. This is a madhouse. The equipment in the other location, it was pretty much installed. The stage was pretty much built, but there's no way that would have happened. The Stones refused to negotiate a penny for the use of that facility. And the sheriff was definitely on the facility owner's side. There was no way they could have done that concert. This Altamont thing shows up, and I mean, literally, they send Rock Scully and Michael Lang, the producer of Woodstock. I'm not really sure what he was doing there, but he just showed up, and they fly over in a helicopter on Thursday afternoon. The concert's supposed to take place on Saturday. And Rock says, they get down over this place, and he looks out, and he sees all these oil stains and broken glass and these piles of wrecked cars from the demolition and derbies, and he's thinking, what the? And he hears Michael Lang speak up. Oh, this is perfect. We can do it here. And, well, that's the guy who did Woodstock. What does he know? He must know something. So that's 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock on Thursday afternoon. They said, okay, let's do it here. So they spent the next 24 hours getting the gear from both the other location and from elsewhere because they couldn't get all the gear out. So it was just crazy kind of caravanning, asking people over the radio if they had trucks to bring it up and help. And then about like 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon, they started building the stage and the sound system. And at noon on Saturday, they had the show.
It's amazing. And people start arriving. The word gets out about where it's going to be, and people start showing up, just throngs, much bigger, I guess, than anyone could have expected.
I talked to the cops that were out there, and they remember it so vividly. It must have been like a science fiction event for them, because the police station in charge of that area was a substation attached to a jail, and there was two patrol cars, one for a little city called Dublin, and the other covered the whole rest of the county from Sunol to Pleasanton, and it was like 900 square miles. And when they went over the hill, the Altamont Pass, they were out of radio reception from the substation. So it was like this tiny, maybe a dead cow in the highway sometimes, that kind of a beat. And I talked to this guy who's walking out the door at 8 in the morning, and the other two guys in the substation are on the phone. He picks up a call. He's leaving work, and they say, well, what do you know about a Rolling Stones concert at Altamont? And this guy means nothing to him because he doesn't know who the Rolling Stones are. So he writes a note down and shoves it across to the desk and leaves. He comes back that night at 5 o'clock, and he's kind of surprised by how much traffic there is going back to work. But he gets there, and they explain to him there's this concert, and they send him out. And he told me this story about, like, driving through the back roads because the highway was too crowded, and he figured if he could, thread his way along. But the back roads, people were just abandoning their cars and walking through them. He said driving through them was like driving through a herd of cattle. And so he finally got south of the highway and drove around the back of the ridge, and he came out on sort of a promontory. It's about midnight, right? And he looks out over this promontory, sees the stage being built in the distance, helicopters lifting airlifting gear, and this big lamp lighting the stage construction. He sees about 50,000 people and about 10,000 campfires. He hears hammers, he hears saws, he hears guitars, he hears people talking, and he just looks over this and he thinks, nothing I can do here, and goes back to where he can get radio reception.
So it has a lot in common with Woodstock, I guess. It just became much bigger than anyone expected, but so much diverges from it. It was hardly Woodstock West, and things went bad pretty much from the beginning. As you note in the book, it was a lot bloodier than maybe what most of us remember, because of, you know, the film Gimme Shelter. Yes, there's video or footage of Hell's Angels wading in and having a fight with this guy who ends up dying, but other people died. And maybe you want to get into that a little bit.
Yeah, well, real early on in my research for the book, I ran across Scott Dudek, who was a homicide investigator for Alameda County Sheriffs. And in 2006, he closed the cold case. And announced that, you know, Meredith Hunter's murder was solved, and got a little name in the newspaper over that. And I Googled him up, and he's in private practice. So I call him up, tell him I'm working on this book, and ask him, did he know about the vehicular manslaughter case? He has no idea. So I've got him interested, and he came to work with me on the book. And there was a whole case that just got buried in the days after Woods, after Altamont, involving two guys from the East Coast, two 22-year-olds who were killed. And then Scott found Jim McDonald for me. And Mac is a stoner, surfer, fireman down in Santa Cruz. And I went down and got his story, and he was fantastic. He remembered he hitchhiked up to the concert, and he remembers every ride he got, and he remembered getting there, running into his high school buddies, and drinking a bunch of wine that was laced with acid, and having a great time. And when he was leaving the concert, he's walking out in the dark across the hill, and there's a car rolling very slowly through the crowd, and he says, you know, can I get a ride? And they said, well, we're going to San Francisco. He says, that'll do. There's a young lady with a baby in the front passenger seat. And they open the back door, and he slides in and gets, there's a couple of guys in the back seat that know each other, but they don't know the guys in the front seat. He figures out pretty quickly. And, you know, it's a kind of a ride group, and everybody's, you know, talking and meeting each other. And there, it takes about 10 minutes to get to the top of the hill because they're going through all this crowd, and they decide there's still too much traffic. So they, build a campfire and park for a mile. And then Mac knew that it gets real cold up there because he'd been hitchhiking through that area before, so he'd brought a blanket. And he got the blanket out of his knapsack, and he pulled it around his shoulders with his fists, you know, holding it in his fists. And the next thing he knows, somebody is shaking his shoulder, and he hears the guy say, "Hey, this one's still alive." So it turns out that some guy, acid-crazed concert goer, believing that the Hell's Angels were chasing him, had stolen a car and driven it through the exiting audience at speeds up to 60 miles an hour, the highway patrol figures. He got to the top of the hill and just launched and landed on this campfire and killed the two guys that were in the back seat next to Mac, severely injured the gal with the baby. The baby was thrown free. And Mac was airlifted by the California Highway Patrol, and he died in that helicopter. He showed up at the Livermore Hospital, flatline, no vital signs. But they brought him back in the emergency room, and when his mother showed up, they gave her his possessions, and among them was this blanket that he had. And on one side of the blanket was the outline of his body in spurts of blood, and the other side was tire tracks.
You know, looking at the big picture, most of the blame seems to go to the Hells Angels for being out of control that day. You have a more nuanced look at their role in the events that unfolded, that some of them truly were out of control. Some were remorseful about what happened. Have you heard from the Angels since the book came out?
Well, of the 40 Hells Angels, and can you believe that 40 Hells Angels made all that much historic trouble, who were there, I could only find three that were still alive, including Sonny Barger, the president of the Oakland chapter. But the other guys that were around, you know, we talked, and they were helpful in explaining the whole point of view. And their point of view, the Angels' point of view on this is very clear. They think that they were duped and played for patsies by the Rolling Stones, and that's not unreasonable. A lot of our impression, if not all of our impressions, really, of this event were formed by that documentary film, Gimme Shelter, which is a great movie, but it's not a journalistic account. And keep in mind that the Rolling Stones were 50% partners in that movie. So to me, that movie looks like an apology to the Stones, who are portrayed as victims, and they demonize the Hells Angels, which is not fair. I knew going in that my book, that it was very important for me to be, and fair is a funny word, and the Hells Angels don't need defending, but I needed to be accurate about the Hells Angels. And the first thing I set out to do was give those guys their names back. All the previous coverage of this, every bit of it, has been Hells Angels this, Hells Angels that. I wanted to find out who these guys were and give them names. They were people. It was Paul Hibbets who beat up the Jefferson Airplane vocalist Marty Balin. They called him Animal. He died a few years ago up in Alaska. His friends thought he was an extremely likable fellow. He was younger than most of the Hells Angels, and sometimes if they were hanging out in bars, he'd have to wait outside while he was still underage. But he also loved fist fighting, and they all remember that about him, too. And, you know, he was terribly intoxicated that day, and he was an awful influence. He beat up Marty twice, both once on stage and afterwards, and he also beat up Rex Jackson, the Grateful Dead roadie, and that was a super significant thing because when Rex went down, everybody backstage knew that that was their last line of defense. He was the enforcer for the Grateful Dead, and with him unconscious and carried off stage with two black eyes, they knew the stage belonged to the Angels.
What do you make of the stories about the plot to kill Mick Jagger? After the movie came out, the Hells Angels being so enraged that there was a plot to murder Mick Jagger actually was launched, according to some accounts.
The accounts all come out of the East Coast, right? That's what I read, is that, and there was some boat episode off Massachusetts Bay. Clubs involved were all West Coast California, and it's not like there was a tight bond between these, like the Fraternal Order of Hell's Angels or something. And I've found over the course of my experience with the Hell's Angels that, you know, their perceived threats far outweighed the reality of it. Oh, don't kid yourself. They, you know, and I don't mean to mythologize or romanticize Hell's Angels. They can be very, very bad boys. But they also get blamed for a lot of stuff they don't do.
You know who didn't get blamed, and you make that note in the story, is the Grateful Dead. They sort of skipped out on the whole thing. Once they saw what was unfolding, they decided not to perform and took off. And their role, you detail it in the book, how integral they were to putting the whole thing together, putting Altamont into place. There was so much that we did not get to cover, both the Grateful Dead's part in it and these mystery characters whom you chronicle, John James and this Goldfinger character. Strange folks, strange vibes all the way around.
Fantastic, huh? Yeah.
Yeah. And then, Joel, it's a wonderful book. I wish I had saved another hour for it. I hope you will keep us in mind when your next book comes out, and we'll have you come back and tell us about whatever that is.
Oh man, this is great. You guys are great. I love the show, and it's a thrill to be a part of it.
Thanks very much. The book is called Altamont, The Rolling Stones, The Hells Angels, and the Inside Story of Rock's Darkest Day. We've just scratched the surface. It's a really fine piece of journalistic work, and thanks, Joel Selvin, for being on the program. In a moment, we switch gears to talk about Melvin Dumar and Howard Hughes. Gary Magnuson has written a book called Stolen Justice. He's the ex-FBI agent who's been digging into this for the past several years. He'll join me in just a couple of minutes, and then a little bit later, Melvin Dumar will be here. Stick around. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Grateful Dead take us into the break.